This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. A UN campaign launched 1 year ago to end statelessness is making progress, but not enough. The EU's Frontex Border Patrol Agency opens its first fast-track migrant registration center on the island of Lesbos in the Aegean Sea. Coming up, music from Mali, and in our feature segment, tribal elders in Kenya are building and maintaining 21st century schools while keeping crucial aspects of the Samburu's ancient desert culture alive and well. I'm Kim Lewis with Yahya Swuheeb, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're beginning in South Africa with a high-profile criminal case.
Kim, just weeks after his release from prison into house arrest, fallen South African star athlete Oscar Pistorius again faces a legal challenge. Prosecutors are trying to convince judges he should be found guilty of murder for killing his girlfriend. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
South African athlete Oscar Pistorius is facing another legal battle that could send him back to prison for years. On Tuesday, state prosecutors argued he should have been convicted of murder, not culpable homicide, for the 2013 killing of his girlfriend. That lesser charge, equivalent to the U.S. charge of manslaughter, earned him a 5-year sentence. He was released on parole on October 19th after a year of time served. Prosecutors believe Judge Tokozile Masipa interpreted the law incorrectly in her verdict. This appeal, unlike the dramatic trial, is highly legalistic in nature, as shown by this argument Prosecutor Harry Nell made Tuesday to the 5-judge appeal panel.
We're not asking this court to substitute the finding and sentence. We're asking this court to substitute the finding but refer back for sentence, because I think it would just be fair that if we have a different conviction, that the accused be allowed the opportunity to lead different evidence.
Pistorius claims he mistook his girlfriend, Riva Steenkamp, for an intruder when he shot 4 times through a locked bathroom door, killing her at his Pretoria home on the night of Valentine's Day. Nell and his legal team argue Pistorius meant to kill Steenkamp. The icon-turned-inmate was not present for the appeal. He is under house arrest at his uncle's Pretoria home and has been restricted to that location. As part of his parole, he is also required to undergo psychotherapy and community service. The judges did not say when they would return with a decision. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
For the first time in history, the International Olympic Committee is allowing highly qualified refugees to compete under the Olympic flag. It comes at a time when the United Nations Refugee Agency says worldwide displacement of civilians has hit an all-time high as war and persecution increases. ANBR reports the new Olympic rule could have a big impact on aspiring refugee athletes.
Loss is a reality that many refugees are all too familiar with. Loss of home, country, and many times, even loved ones. IOC Chief Thomas Bach of Germany says the International Olympic Committee is all too aware of these circumstances, especially for athletes.
Having no national team to belong to, having no flag to march behind, having no national anthem to be played for them, these refugee athletes will be welcomed to the Olympic Games with the Olympic flag and with the Olympic anthem.
Bach made the announcement to the UN General Assembly last week. He also called for a resolution to demand that all UN members recognize a truce during the 2016 Summer Games in Brazil. The resolution, entitled Building a Peaceful and Better World Through Sport and the Olympic Ideal, was supported by 180 out of 193 member states. It calls for the Olympic truce to be respected from 7 days before the start of the Olympic Games until 7 days after the Paralympic Games, which follow the Olympics. Bach says the Olympics symbolize tolerance, solidarity, and peace. South Sudanese marathon runner Gwar Macaire, who ran independently under the Olympic flag in 2012, says that message will resonate strongly with refugees around the world.
It's significant because it gives opportunity. Give opportunity to the refugees, and it gives a hope. That's the thing about the sport and the Olympic, the spirit of the sport.
McCare, known as the athlete with no country in the 2012 Games, says he personally knows how important this recognition will be to millions of refugees worldwide.
Wherever they go, they will say, okay, I am a refugee, and I have opportunity in the international community, and I can compete. I can be an athlete. I can be a world champion with no fear saying I don't have a paperwork. I don't have a nationality, and I will not be able to compete. So for the IOC to make such a decision is actually giving a great spirit to all the refugees youth across all over the world.
McCare says since refugees have faced so much adversity, they are mentally strong. He says the Olympics are an important opportunity for world-class refugee athletes to overcome unimaginable odds.
I'm pretty sure there were a lot of, some of them were athletes in their own country. But now with the dilemma and the situation they are in, the might be feeling that everything is falling apart and there is the end of it. But my message to them is to keep their hope alive and focus.
The 2016 Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro will take place from August 5th to the 21st. They will be followed by the Paralympic Games from September 7th to the 18th. McCare has been training in Kenya with other South Sudanese long-distance runners to compete for South Sudan in the 2016 Olympics. For VOA News, I'm Ian Bior in Washington.
Voice of America!
This is the Voice of America. Washington, D.C.
Hello, everybody. From that very first broadcast during World War II, and ever since, the Voice of America has been the voice of freedom. So on behalf of the American people and the millions around the world who draw hope and strength from your work, thank you all for being the proud and steady Voice of America.
Voice of America!
And thank you, President Obama, for your support of the Voice of America. In African football, the field is now set for the 2016 African Nations Championship, also called CHAN 2016, which will be hosted by Rwanda. The VOA's Nightline Africa sportsman, Shay Goon, dot on the spot at Adeyemi, has more details for us.
Good evening, Africa. All the 16 finalists for the 2016 African Nations Championship have now emerged, following the qualification of Ivory Coast and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Ivory Coast defeated Ghana 1-0 in their return leg match to tie 2-2 on aggregates. But the Elephants prevailed on the away goal rule. For its part, DR Congo walked over the Central African Republic, which pulled out of the competition. The 16 qualifiers emerged from the six zones under which the qualifying tournaments were played. Overall, 42 teams participated in the qualifying series. The finals of the fourth edition of the two-yearly tournament will be hosted by Rwanda from January 16th to February 7th, 2016. The African Nations Championship is designed exclusively for players in the continent's domestic leagues. The following are the qualified teams for the 2016 tournament: Northern Zone, Morocco and Tunisia; Zone West A, Mali and Guinea; Zone West B, Ivory Coast, Niger, and Nigeria; Central Zone, DR Congo, Cameroon, and Gabon; Central East Zone, host Rwanda, Uganda, and Ethiopia; and Southern Zone, Angola, Zimbabwe, and Zambia. In other news, German Volker Finke has been sacked as coach of the Cameroon national team, according to the country's football federation, FECAFOOT. The decision was taken at an executive meeting of FECAFOOT, where Alexander Belinga was appointed as interim coach. Finke's contract expired several weeks ago and will not be renewed after a number of disappointments over the past 18 months. Finke's sack comes 2 weeks before the side begins its qualification campaign for the 2018 World Cup in Russia with a two-leg second-round tie against Niger. The 67-year-old coach led Cameroon in its abysmal World Cup campaign in Brazil last year, where the indomitable Lions lost all three group matches. The Lions were also knocked out in the first round of the African Nations Cup finals in Equatorial Guinea earlier this year. Thanks so much for listening. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Africa. Dr. Larry Zamoje here, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 88.9 Brilla FM. Keep getting sporty sunshine with Sunny Young. We all do at Sports Radio 88.9 Brilla FM, broadcasting out of the cities of Lagos, Abuja, Kaduna, and Onitsha in Nigeria, as well as the World Wide Web on www.brillafm.net. I tell you this, it's always a thrill, yes, a thrill, to remain on the sunny side on Brilla with Sunny. Keep listening, Africa.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
They're playing basketball. We love that basketball.
In National Basketball Association news, LeBron James and Tim Duncan both achieved major milestones Monday night. LeBron became the youngest player to reach 25,000 career points. The 30-year-old James tallied 22 points, 11 assists, and 9 rebounds in Cleveland's 107-100 road victory over Philadelphia. And Tim Duncan played in his NBA record 954th victory with one team in San Antonio's 94-84 road win over the New York Knicks. From New York City, Duncan and the Spurs now travel south here to Washington to play my favorite NBA team, the Washington Wizards, on Wednesday night at the Verizon Center Arena, located just a few blocks from our Voice of America headquarters. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yehias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up in Kenya, tribal elders building and maintaining 21st century schools. And next, the World Health Organization just launched new standards to improve the quality of adolescent care. But first, some music. Here is Salif Keita of Mali with Yambo.
Don't get up.
Salif Keita of Mali with Yambo.
In Africa, policymakers, NGOs, and grassroots activists agree that education is key if the continent is to compete effectively amid globalization. Until recently, the Samburu, a traditional pastoralist people in remote northeastern Kenya, had little access to the education needed to cope with the encroaching modern world. One U.S.-based nonprofit group is working with tribal elders to build and maintain 21st-century schools while keeping crucial aspects of the Samburu's ancient desert culture alive and well. VOA's Adam Phillips reports.
The Samburu are a semi-nomadic people who depend on their ancient skills and wits to survive in the desert with their cattle, goats, and camels. Their warriors carry spears, and their women are adorned with elaborate, brilliantly colored beads that denote their status within the tribe. Thorn Tree Project founder Jane Newman says the Samburu live far away from modern Africa.
They're very isolated. They're cut off from the rest of the world. There's no roads, no telephones, no prenatal care, no running water, nothing.
Newman first met the Samburu in 1999 when her vehicle broke down on a backcountry adventure. During her brief stay with them, she was struck by their hospitality and their sense that education might be their culture's lifeline.
Before I met them, all the elders had realized that the modern world was encroaching, and they realized they were not at all prepared for it. They couldn't speak English or Kiswahili. They couldn't communicate with the outside world. They didn't know what resources were available that they could ask for or how to ask for them. And also they were afraid of being taken advantage of. So they asked us, me at the time, if I could help them get more of their kids to go to school.
Newman returned about 2 years later, ready to help.
At that time, in the two pre-primary schools, they had 130 students, and maybe about a quarter of them graduated. But their main problem, and the main thing that we deal with, is the fact that they're nomadic. So these three schools that are in their area are anywhere from 10 to 100 kilometers away from the family. So if they're migrating or moving, their children have to go to boarding school. So that was clearly a problem because they didn't have any real boarding facilities.
And the other issue was that few of them had been to school and most didn't know what school was. So the Thorn Tree Project started with two preschools.
And they've been hugely successful. We actually have 15 of them now. They're run by the community. They make all the decisions. A warrior with at least 2 years' experience is the teacher or a mother. So they usually have like a spear in one hand and a piece of chalk in the other. And there's no building, it's just mobile. So they find the largest shady thorn tree around, prop a blackboard up against a tree trunk, and then that's the school. When you go and visit them, you'll see like 30, 40 tiny children sitting around, loving it.
Today, nearly 1,400 Samburu attend preschool or primary school. Over 150 young people have received Thorn Tree scholarships for secondary school, which is the normal gateway in Kenya to higher education at a trade school or university, which many have also now attended. Not that their need for Western-style education means the Samburu are ignorant. Newman says that's far from the case.
Because they have this huge education program themselves, because looking after cows in the desert is extremely difficult. And in fact, if you try to live their life and succeed, you'd be really hard-pressed. So there's a huge body of knowledge which is passed on to the mothers, the children, the warriors, from the older people over a long period of time that is their formal education. It usually takes places around ceremonies and so on, but there's a lot of instruction.
For example, the Samburu pass on information culled during a horrific drought a century ago about which plants might thrive and where during current dry spells. The Thorn Tree Project works with elders to ensure this knowledge is preserved in the push for Western education and the jobs that may follow.
In fact, the elders themselves see this as a way to protect their culture. If you go to school, you can get a job So during a bad drought, and the droughts are very frequent and escalating in intensity, somebody that's working in and got a job can send money home, and there's no malnutrition in that family. And also at the end of the drought, when they've lost all their animals, that person will be able to help them to buy 2 cows so that they can start up again. So that was definitely an insurance policy for their culture.
Education allows the Samburu to take jobs previously held by others sent to the region by the Kenyan government. But the region is considered a hardship post, and many from the outside don't deal well with conditions there.
So we had a series of nurses that were either drunk or just never turned up, that couldn't speak Samburu, didn't care about the patients. And one of our very first students that went to high school did a 2-year diploma in nursing in Mombasa. And when I was there in April, he'd just come back, finished, and he was there at the clinic. And it was just amazing because he could speak the language. He knew all the families, and he slept over the top of the dispensary. So the whole community was just delighted.
Other jobs that now go to Samburu who've been educated through the Thorn Tree Project include school teachers and rangers at a nearby nature reserve. Many now also work in the tourism and hospitality industries. Jane Newman's friend, Clodagh, an Irish-born interior and fashion designer based in New York, has raised funds for the Thorn Tree Project from the start. During one of her many trips to the region, Clodagh got a happy surprise in a remote game lodge far from the Ndanya Wasson area where many Samburu live.
Behind the desk was this really beautiful woman, and she said, "Oh, where are you coming from?" And I said, "Oh, I'm not sure you'd know where. It's a remote place in Ndanya Wasson." "Oh," she said, "I went to school there. I was in the boarding school there." It turns out she was one of our pupils. I'm not going to cry now, but I cried then. I mean, we were hugging each other and crying. It was so wonderful that we actually had created a job through education for somebody who is now working in tourism. There's nothing abstract about it. It's physical, it's hugging, it's just very important.
The Thorn Tree Project owes much of its success to the personal connections it fosters. Its administration is 100% volunteer, so all contributions go to schools, infrastructure, and scholarships, not bureaucracy. Both Jane Newman and Clodagh say that as the Thorn Tree Project continues to grow, its emphasis will broaden as well. Future plans include greater opportunities for girls and women to become leaders within the Samburu tribe and in Kenya overall. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
UN health officials say health care for adolescents is substandard and fails to provide critical prevention and care services. From Geneva, Lisha Schlein reports the World Health Organization and UNAIDS have just launched new standards to improve the quality of adolescent care.
Young people between the ages of 10 and 19 confront many physical and emotional changes. They do not like to be treated as children, yet they do not know how to behave like adults. Authors of the new adolescent health standards say young people are vulnerable to particular health problems and many engage in behavior that can lead to disability or death. Anthony Costello, WHO's Director of Maternal, Children's and Adolescents Health, says lifelong behaviors begin during puberty.
35% of the global burden of disease starts in adolescence. Mental health would be an area particularly where early intervention could make a great deal of difference to the life course, if you like, and the future illnesses in adulthood.
The study cites the top 3 causes of death among adolescents as road traffic injuries, AIDS-related illnesses, and suicide. UNAIDS senior advisor Dirk van Hove says adolescents are at high risk of HIV/AIDS because of risky behavior.
About 30 cases of new infections among adolescents happen every hour. And HIV among adolescents is still the leading cause of death in sub-Saharan Africa and the second leading cause of death in the world.
The report finds many adolescents who suffer from mental health disorders, substance abuse, poor nutrition, intentional injuries, and chronic illness do not have access to critical prevention and care services. The new standards recommend adolescents be provided with free or low-cost consultations and medical information appropriate appropriate for their age, and they should be able to access health services without requiring parental consent. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Once the fighting ends, peace treaties are signed and armies disbanded, too often the world assumes that life in former conflict areas will soon return to normal. But in many countries, landmines and unexploded munitions kill and maim their victims decades after the original conflict is little more than an ugly memory. Leftover landmines and unexploded munitions stand in the way of post-conflict stabilization and inhibit long-term development. They render thousands of acres of land unusable and destabilize communities. Clearly, people can only realize the benefits of a return to peace once these deadly hazards are removed. Since 1993, the United States has been part of a concentrated effort to clear and destroy poorly secured, unstable, or illegally traded conventional weapons of war. So far, we have invested $2.5 billion into this drive. In addition, every year the United States Department of State releases To Walk the Earth in Safety, a report which details the previous year's efforts to reduce the harmful effects of these remnants of war. This year's report notes that in 2014, four projects in particular stood out. First, we launched a five-year initiative to completely demine Vietnam's Quang Tri province and increased our funding for the clearance project tenfold. In the Middle East, we helped fund the Halo Trust's work in the West Bank, a first-of-its-kind effort to clear the mines there. In Tajikistan, we funded the first and only all-female demining team in Central Asia. And finally, we work to help destroy illicit and at-risk weapons and munitions stockpiles in Chad, Niger, and Bosnia and Herzegovina. To Walk the Earth in Safety not only provides detailed information of our programs in these countries, it makes clear the real differences these programs make in the lives of countless people, said Rose Guatemala, Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security. With the help of our NGO partners, we have turned one-time battlegrounds into land for vital infrastructure. We have cleared minefields so that farmers can get back to their fields and children can walk to school safely in Angola and other countries. These inspirational programs touch thousands of lives all over the world, from children in Sri Lanka who can now safely walk to school to farmers in Vietnam who can now tend to their crops without fear.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Escape from the humdrum and dance to the beat of an African drum. Hi, I am David Van, host of the Voice of America's African Beat. Blended sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. Join me Monday through Friday at 0900 and 2000 UTC for a soothing musical journey. I guarantee.